Jazz Arts and Culture Show.
Don't make me say it's so hot right now.
Tan caliente ahora!
Your weekly dose of arts and culture.
And all of that sort of stuff.
It's that weird thing that they're classics because they're classics because they're classics, and then they become the classics and everyone wants to do the classics because they're classics.
He's amazing.
Well, you need a lot of room for all that blood.
And he's hot as a firecracker.
You're listening to So Hot Right Now. You better not use me saying that.
Amazing babes.
On 2SER 107.3.
Good morning and welcome to So Hot Right Now, your weekly dose of arts and culture. And before we get started, I would like to acknowledge the Gadigal people who are the traditional custodians of this land from which we are broadcasting. I would also like to pay my respect to elders past, present and emerging of the Eora Nation. So hello everyone, welcome to So Hot Right Now, where we talk from 11 a.m. until 12 p.m. about all things arts and culture, specifically with a Sydney focus. We range everything from theatre to performance to dance to visual art to literally everything you could possibly think of. And I think today's show is a great reflection of that. We are talking about Rainbow Holi. So if you know Holi, that's that festival that happens in South Asia around March every year that involves the throwing of colour, and it's a celebration of camaraderie and friendship. And a few collectives in Sydney, including Fob Gaze, are bringing this amazing festival to Sydney with a little bit of a queer rainbow spin, rainbow in the other meaning. So we'll be chatting to Sid from Fob Gaze a little bit later on the show about that and what we can expect there. We also have Letter from the Editor number 2, which is the second installment of our collaboration with Running Dog. And Running Dog, if you don't know, is a online e-arts e-magazine for arts run by Naomi Riddle and assisting editor Hannah Jenkins, who speak to my producer Amelia all about this letter. It's a response to this piece of writing that comes out on the magazine every month, kind of detailing a few different elements happening in the art world and kind of meditating on what that means and how that reflects in Sydney. So I'm very much looking forward to that. It's a really interesting conversation. And first up on the show, we'll be hearing from Perth-based artist Nathan Beard about his solo exhibition White Guilt 2.0, which has just opened up at First Draft over in Woolloomooloo. He is one of my absolute favourite artists, and if you haven't heard of him, please stick around and listen to what he has to say. He does some amazing, amazing work. I actually bought one of them, so I'm really excited to speak to him about White Guilt. It's a really great series. So that's what we've got going on. Stay with us. There's a lot to learn, a lot to listen to, and to get us warmed up, I'm going to play a track. This is a collaboration from Little Dragon and Caliuchis. This is Are You Feeling Sad? Good morning, everyone. Great track there from Little Dragon and Caliucci's. Hello and welcome back to So Hot Right Now with myself, Nicole Beck. We are talking all things art and all things culture. And specifically, we are talking about White Guilt 2.0. So embedded in Thai culture are various hand gestures, each with distinctive meanings. So solo exhibition White Guilt 2.0 by artist Nathan Beard unpacks the cultural associations and idiosyncrasies of some of these hand gestures. So in the show, Beard develops gestures through a unique set of cultural anxieties that influence his approach to his Thai Australian heritage. So White Guilt 2.0 brings a beautiful selection of photographs and sculptures to First Draft for their March exhibitions. So joining us on the line to give us a little bit more insight into the show is Nathan himself, all the way from Perth. Good morning, Nathan.
Good morning, Nicole.
So I think a good place to start is White Guilt is kind of embedded with symbolism and associations of the why, if I'm saying that correctly. So yep, can you describe what that is and kind of what that means for you?
Yeah, so the why is a customary greeting in Thai culture. So you would recognize it from any sorts of imagery of cultural tourism to Thailand. It's when you greet someone, you clasp your hands in front of you in sort of like a prayer-like gesture. And it sort of dates back to around the 12th century as a indication that you weren't armed. And so what I thought was interesting was I have always sort of felt uneasy around performing the wire around my mother's family and Thai friends especially, just purely because growing up in Australia, it always felt not like a, but like a secondary, sorry, not like a primary gesture. It just never felt automatic for me. It always felt like there was some element of cultural performance or being put on show. So I think my own sense of unease around it was interesting for me to try to unpack.
And did you find that you kind of came to any revelations through like kind of confronting your unease through creating this exhibition?
I think what I ended up sort of settling on was this sense of the sense of unease around performing it probably had a lot to do with extraneous circumstances about performing my own sense of cultural otherness within an Australian context. And I'm thinking specifically when I was a kid growing up, it would have been, you know, in the early to mid 90s. And when I started being conscious around my mother being Thai and how that othered her was when I was in primary school. And there was also a lot of rhetoric around like One Nation's sort of like scare tactics around the Asian Australian population coming in and stealing jobs. And I know that there was definitely that sort of trickle-down effect. The teasing and all that sort of stuff wasn't like super, it wasn't severe or anything like that compared to what other people would have experienced. But it definitely sort of raised a consciousness about that. So I think in processing my unease around it, I sort of had to sort of dive into a lot of the circumstances around it, I guess, that made me sort of approach it cautiously.
And so in exploring the why, you've created a really amazing series of photographs kind of featuring hands with really long fake nails holding orchids. Can you talk us through these aesthetic choices and what led you to them?
Yeah, so I became interested in this idea of cultural performance and performativity. And when I think about sort of the way that hand gestures are incorporated into a lot of like national arts in Thailand, particularly dance and performance, it's all about hand gestures performing these really nice extensions that are symbolic of like flowers and plants and things like that. And I always had at the back of my head my mom saying that my hands were sort of naturally beautifully curved, and that if I was born in Thailand as a girl, I would have been able to be a good sort of Thai dancer. She'd always joke about that with me. And so when I was thinking about how best to sort of, I guess, unpack the different sort of meanings behind this idea of cultural performance and performativity, is using my untrained hands to try to approximate the different positions in traditional Thai dance led to that series of photographs. The reason I've used the nails is a reference to brass finger extensions. So traditional Thai dancers wear these brass nails, brass finger extensions that are meant to elongate the form of the hand. And so my approach to it was using fake nails and then adorning those in different patterns and techniques to sort of allude to that. The orchids are symbolic because of their association with, I guess, cultural promotion and tourism in Thailand as well. So those orchids are all over marketing for like the national airline Thai Airways. They're always associated with Thai businesses as well. Like if you look up just like Thai orchid and Google it in like your local hometown, you end up coming up with these like countless hits for like Thai massage or Thai restaurants. So incorporating those into these photographs was just a way of drawing in those different relationships.
I'm interested in, and this is kind of for personal reasons because I love the color purple, but it's yeah. It's very purple. Is that, does that mean anything, or is that just a natural kind of thing?
Yeah, it's the symbolism of the color as well. So that royal purple comes up a lot in Thai, just sort of like Thai branding, Thai cultural branding. You always see that sort of deep royal purple. And it's always sort of like different Pantone shades of purple are always like Siamese when they're sort of that sort of spectrum of colour as well.
And so these images are also paired with some sculptures and some other photographs outside of this series. How do these works kind of converse in the space, and what dialogue were you hoping to create here?
Yeah. So specifically with the this body of work, I was always wanting to produce a really dense layer of textures in the gallery and sort of use them only on sort of two planes. So in first draft in gallery two, it works really perfectly because the two walls where all the work is hung as a series of, in the installation, they meet to that corner point. So the idea was sort of being able to format everything so that the viewer looking at it from any sort of vantage point, it's just sort of like accretion and overwhelming layering of different like media and techniques. So incorporating the sculptural element was a way of being able to add sort of depth to that as well. It was also a way to be able to physically model the decorations that I was using for the photographs as well, just being able to play with that sort of in and outside of the picture frame, the pictorial frame. I think that's why there's different textures of photographs. So you've got photos that are mounted onto aluminium. You've got photos that are framed behind acrylic or non-reflective glass. You've got prints on wall vinyl, and you've got prints on paper that are directly pinned into the wall as well. So it's just sort of trying to create this really visually extravagant way of kind of communicating this sort of overwhelming sense of themes and concepts that I was sort of drawing upon when I'm trying to unpack my own personal affiliation with sort of just something as simple as the hand gesture within a culture.
And so one of those major themes is kind of this idea of authenticity as well as inauthenticity, which kind of underscores the exhibition asking questions about the shifting nature of an authentic, in inverted commas, Thai culture. Can you shed a little bit of light about that idea of authenticity and how it kind of informs your work?
Yeah. The approach to the culture really draws upon sort of looking at the historical influences of what is deemed a national Thai culture. So within Thai culture, this idea of Thai-ness is sort of part of it's part of the national identity, and it's one of the three sort of foundations of Thai culture itself, is this idea of like how Thai something is and how authentically Thai something is. But historically, Thai culture is a hybrid of different influences ranging from sort of Indian and Chinese cultures. And in the 20th century, particularly with the increase of globalization as well, that's obviously shifting the boundaries of what is and isn't authentically Thai. When you look at something like Pad Thai, that was created in the mid-20th century because they wanted to produce a national dish. And so it was a competition that was held in order to sort of like create an iconic dish for Thailand. And so I think a lot of it historically has to do with the fact that Thailand historically never was colonized. Instead, what they did was adopt Western political maneuvering and exchange of land and that sort of thing in order to sort of resist being colonized by the French or the English. And so this sort of slipperiness, this adeptness at being able to shift culturally, I think, just finds a really interesting, my position growing up in Australia with the influence of the Thai mum, it just feels sort of analogous to that sort of broader historical context. The really interesting thing for me was that my mum, all through her life in Thailand was definitely incorporating elements of Thai culture into the domestic space. Her home was full of shrines, the garden was full of Thai plants and vegetables, and just sort of her way of incorporating that into a foreign context, and then that was the context that I was growing up with. So subjectively, you know, for me, like that feels authentically Thai because it speaks of this direct matrilineal line.
And I think we have time for one last question, which kind of is the kind of opposite of that. But White Guilt 2.0 also kind of presents an investigation into your own kind of sense of whiteness. I'm interested in how this artistic practice or like this artistic process, what that kind of revealed for you about like your own whiteness and how that may have transformed through creating this work, etc.
Yeah. I think in the process of researching this body of work, it just sort of became more and more obvious that what I was doing was applying this filter of trying to understand and position myself in relationship to a culture, and this sort of like struggle to sort of process this sort of anxiety around authenticity and cultural performance. I think that in and of itself is a condition of whiteness. This self politicking of trying to negotiate that sort of cultural space and determine what are sort of like acceptable boundaries within it and around it. So I think that that's an interesting position to sort of start from, and then through the process of making and designing the sort of visual layers within the show, sort of have fun with that and subvert the expectations of that. So I think what the work ultimately positions itself as is sort of, I guess, a celebration.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely, especially when you've got like the kind of extravagant imagery and colour and that kind of thing. It definitely transforms into a celebratory kind of mood.
Yeah, just an explosion of sort of like influences and trying to make them, so I'm trying to bring a sort of levity to the way that it's presented, knowing that it's ultimately sort of dealing with this sort of deeply sort of personal and complex sort of strategizing and positioning.
Yeah, there's that duality there.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on the show this morning, Nathan. It was an absolute pleasure to talk to you and hear about the work.
All right, thank you for having me and for seeing the work.
Anytime. So we've just been speaking about White Guilt 2.0, which is a solo exhibition from Nathan Beard. You can see the show at First Draft from now until March 27th. And the artist talk for the show is on the 26th of March from 6 to 7 p.m. if you'd like to hear more from Nathan there. And right now I'm going to play a track. This is a new one from Caribou. This is Home. You are tuned into So Hot right now.
Just what she pleases. Cause she's happy on her own. And she picks up all the pieces. She's going home.
Baby, I'm home, I'm home, I'm home.
Yeah, she's going home.
Baby, I'm home, I'm home, I'm home.
Cause she hit it on her own. There's so much she can teach me. She's going home.
Baby, I'm home, I'm home, I'm home.
Yeah, she's going home.
Baby, I'm home, I'm home, I'm home.
Girls unleashes her fierce intelligence on the new album, Heavy Light. A colourful and vibrant vision of the times we live in. US Girls, Heavy Light is out now on CD, vinyl and all digital services. Brought to you by Remote Control, 2SER sponsors.
Hello and welcome back to So Hot Right Now, where we talk about all things art and all things culture. And if you missed my last conversation, it was with artist Nathan Beard talking about White Guilt 2.0, which is his solo exhibition now open at First Draft. You can also listen back to that chat and anything else that we talk about on the show if you look for our show page on the 2SER website, looking just for So Hot Right Now. And you can find everything there. And right now we're kicking on with our next segment, which is all about Running Dog and the letter from the editor. Wow. That was confusing. So the space between art for others and art for the self must be simultaneous, contradictory, vulnerable, slanted. These are words by Terence Hayes from 2019. Do you agree? With another month done and dusted, it means we're back with another installment of our collaboration with arts e-magazine Running Dog. So this is part of a desire we have to involve different voices from our arts community and also to elevate an arts criticism voice in our programming. So for this collaboration, we will invite founding editor Naomi Riddle and assisting editor Hannah Jenkins to elaborate on a monthly piece in the magazine Letter from the Editor, February. So our producer Amelia speaks with Hannah and Naomi to find out more.
This is the first time we've done this segment before. So for anyone who doesn't know what Running Dog
is. That is not the right one. That is actually last month. Let me just play you a quick track and we'll come back to that in a hot second. So just hang tight. It is incoming.
Since coming of age, my confusion still hasn't changed. My mixed race place in the world kept me in disarray. Escape, roll of my conundrum and smoke it all away. Never paid much attention. Teachers couldn't explain life meanings. Better LS dreaming, psychedelic teachings. Up the road, a friend has some dream keef in the back. Promise the answers to be had, universal.
You really thought that you could be part of this war, huh? You really thought that you can connect with the soul, huh? You really thought that I had the answers. Some sets you upset to transform it, upsets it never ends. I am me, I am me, identity offended.
All right, we're going to give that another go. Sorry for that confusion. We've only got two, but I somehow managed to conflate them. So this is the letter to the editor from February. If it plays. Nope. Okay, that's cool. We'll come back to it again. Back to the Sampa the Great, which I'm sure you can all enjoy anyway. Sorry to cut it off.
I am yet to reckon the patient for visible reflection. I lit it up and held my breathe in, breathe out. I'm on the third cloud of set. Feel the presence of an outer body stranger. The danger to float away, an angel in a manger. Clicks and sunny blips, it relayed to my pager. My ancient ancestors call, I'm calling in a favor. I heard the calling of an outer body stranger. The danger to float away, an angel in a manger. Clicks and sunny blips, it relayed to my pager. My ancient ancestors call, I'm calling in a favor.
Who you talking to? Who you speaking to? Who you think I am? What you wanna be? Yeah. This the footpath the angels untamed. We journey to the center and change your unnamed. Spirit Nelson, spirit bloodline, spirit heal us and again. DNA, hear him say, the oldest of the land. He looks within. The chart turns to see dust. The heart turns to fear us. To fear us. The heart turns to fear us.
And we're back with round three of the Running Dog segment. And I know this time it's going to work. So here we are. This is Running Dog, letter to the editor, number two.
It's been a big month, right?
Yes.
It's been a big month for Running Dog. You've had your micro residencies. You've got a bunch of new feature articles. And yes. You also have an event called Automate Me at Verge Galleries. Can you talk a little bit about what's been going on?
Well, maybe a little too much, I think, for both of us.
No. It always feels like that.
Well, we just had our first event for the year at Verge Gallery, Automate Me, which is actually running in tandem with an online issue that we will be publishing this week, which will have like a combination of Australian and international writers, which will be really exciting, and also bringing together writers who may be working in tech or code alongside artists and fiction writers. And we actually, for some reason, have a lot of pieces that relate to food in some way. So
oh, right.
I don't know. There's something I don't know.
Yeah.
How does this issue differ from what you usually produce on the site?
I think one of the big aims for it was for us to acknowledge that art and writing about art actually happens like in a wider dialogue with talking just about culture more broadly. So the aim is to sort of pick some themes that really touch those kind of cultural and social points in everyone's lives. So that first one is all about automation.
Mm, and how have you found the event process as a way of bringing people in a real space as opposed to online?
Yeah, I think, well, because we started our partnership with Verge Gallery for the first time last year, we did four events. And part of that was really trying to think about ways that we could have some conversations with our readership in, I want to say in real life, but offline, particularly because if our aim is to not engage with social media in the way that it tries to dictate that we engage with it, so we don't really respond to comments or have a very active online presence, we wanted a way to then have a conversation offline that allowed us to circumnavigate or get outside of those spaces.
And, you know, like speaking of opening up a dialogue, this most recent letter from the editor, I thought it was really interesting. We were just talking about it before. The framework for the beginning of the letter is a list of responses of things that you don't want to discuss. So could you talk a bit about that?
Very sneaky. Well, I think, particularly because February is a short month, this letter came around for me very quickly. And I think there is something a bit, dare I say, exhausting working in that medium on a monthly basis. So this one, I think, particularly because the January letter, I had, I guess, a lot more time to think about what I wanted to say. It was a bit of a struggle, this one, for me. And I think there were a lot of avenues that I went down that I thought of things that I could write about, particularly in terms of funding and the relationship between the government and funding, just because a lot of stories that came out this month, such as the sports rights scandal for one, which reminded me of an issue with the New South Wales government in terms of arts funding that was redirected without anyone's knowledge who had submitted that grant application. And then also just this announcement by the Judith Nielsen Foundation with the Copyright Agency to donate money to News Corp and Nine to increase arts coverage. And I think it becomes really tricky to talk about funding in a way that doesn't sound like a complaint or speaking to a particular group of people who have that conversation often. And I think particularly in Australia, most arts organisations don't have any money. There's a lot of volunteer work, so it kind of felt unhelpful to continue that conversation.
Definitely. It feels like in the case of funding that Arts in Australia is very much trapped between, you know, government funding or then you were saying like private funding in terms of philanthropy.
Yep.
Do you think those sort of pressures to produce can have a stifling effect on creativity for the individual?
Sure. And I think Australia is in a particular, I don't know, U-bend or bottleneck with in terms of funding in that the funding is shrinking on the one hand, and then we also have so many artists then choosing to take postgraduate study as a means of getting some alternative funding through the institutions, which then means that a lot of the work that we produce is speaking to a very specific language and way of making art, which is quite institutional. And then that in itself has a flow-on effect of being separated from, I guess, more community-based practice. And all of this, I think, is completely a result of issues of financial stress. But at the same time, that's where it becomes tricky because everyone in this economy is under a form of financial stress and it becomes a bit redundant to fall into the trap of constantly complaining about it.
It is interesting, I suppose, to talk about like that kind of academic tone of arts culture, and you do sort of bring that up in the letter as well. I felt very called out.
In the letter.
But you say it as well. It is. We're all guilty. We're dismissive of art that isn't political or sort of speaking to some kind of cerebral theme. And so I think it's actually very clever to dedicate space and thought to a different kind of art, like I suppose like that, a more universal kind of art that is much more interested in that, like just intrinsic good and the value of, just drawing and mark making.
From my perspective, when I read it, there's almost this innate pressure to produce that can result in self-criticism and then criticism of people around you. And that's not the intentionality of what it means to actually create things. And towards the end of the letter, you really draw on that point, saying that the focus should be on creating and the making and the act of the process itself. And I found it really interesting, you just talking about Australia and our current model, because you spent some time last year in New York and you talk about your experience with this particular exhibition called The Pencil is a Key. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think this exhibition in particular, so The Pencil is a Key, was at the Drawing Centre. And I think I saw it maybe 3 days before I left in December, I think. It closed in January. And it was drawings by incarcerated artists. But the earliest work was drawn during the French Revolution, and then it went up all the way to the present day. So the most recent work was from 2019 by an artist detained in Turkey for speaking out against the government, who was also a journalist, actually. You know, it was one of those exhibitions that you go to, and I think I had fallen into the trap, which I talk about in the letter, of being a bit critical of what art is and always thinking about that conversation of the relationship between art and politics. And I guess maybe even being a bit hardline in how I dealt with, you know, works that might have been more abstract or were super commercial. And I think this particular exhibition, there was a relationship between all those artists. And I think it really reiterated to me, I don't know, it kind of made me feel a bit silly to even have spent so much time worrying about that demarcation between art and politics, because obviously it was an incredibly political show. It had a huge public program because America is dealing with kind of a crisis of incarceration. So there was a lot of public programs that were working to kind of deal with prison reform and prison abolition. So that kind of gave it its weight, but it was also very much reiterating the value in drawing itself, or just of making, and you know, for artists who never expected that work to be shown or shared in any way. And I think that can be very powerful.
I feel like it almost comes back to a question of intentionality, because if you're incarcerated and you're creating these works, there's no other intention behind producing it other than the sake of making. Like, you're not thinking about, oh, maybe this gallery might be putting it on, whereas the system here in Australia is almost, like you were saying at the beginning of the letter, that we're chasing grant funding and whether it fits within this rubric or model or this kind of more prescriptive narrative or lens within contemporary art, I guess.
Yeah. Yes. Even in itself, it was contradictory and problematic and confusing because, you know, it on the one hand, these artists are making work, so it kind of celebrates the making, but they're also incarcerated, and particularly, you know, there were works by artists who were in internment camps. There were works by artists who were in concentration camps in Poland in the 1940s. There were many works by artists who had died in prison. So I think there was definitely a tension there about, you know, why they were making and whether they were just making to survive or whether they were documenting or whether even for some artists it was about like bartering. It had a value as a way of, you know, whether that was with the prison guards or with how they engaged. Do you know what I mean? Like, and I think that's also important to think that it's all tangled up together. And I think that's what's really interesting, because we always want to make it cleaner, I guess, or easier. Whereas I think that I'm at the point now that I'm more interested in something that has that unresolved tension. And you know, I feel like many people who saw that exhibition may find it problematic or have issues with it. And that's kind of interesting too. Like, I feel like we are in an age where we dislike confusion and contradictory feelings.
And when it comes to that unresolved tension, this, I guess, is a question for both of you. How would you potentially imagine that within the context of an Australian or a Sydney-based exhibition? Or are you guys trying to do that with the events and work that you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because part of that letter, I think, came out of having seen the Cornelia Parker exhibition here at the MCA and having reviewed that the week before, which also, interestingly, drew on prison labour, but in a very different way, whereas I felt the agency was completely different. But again, I feel like that was an exhibition that, yes, I thought it was important to critique, but I can still see the incredible value of having to wrestle with that. I don't think that that exhibition shouldn't have been shown. It's more that there's value in critique.
Yeah, completely. And I think that, same as Naomi, like, I don't think I can approach this from any other angle than as someone who does personally just really like to think about and write about art. But it is like you get the most pleasure and satisfaction from things that are a bit curly or tangled up. And I think that that's something that we don't give ourselves a lot of time to do, like just to reflect. And so I think that even just ties quite nicely back into the entire ethos of Running Dog as well.
Totally.
Which is to sort of give that space for that deeper reflection rather than just things being black or white, you know, like, or a simple assessment of like good or bad. Like, I think things can really exist in like a multitude of states with a multitude of interpretations. But it is like, that's something that I think people are really uncomfortable with. But I think, yeah, I would like to see more people like be satisfied with like an unresolved assessment. Yeah.
That was Naomi and Hannah speaking with Amelia for Letters from the Editor, February. This is a monthly collaborative segment with Running Dog. And if you're interested to find out more about their publication, you can head to rundog.art or head to our show page where we'll add all the links to Naomi's letter so you can find them all there. And we'll also put a kind of podcast up of this chat if you want to listen back again or listen to last month's, which I tried to play earlier for some unknown reason. Anyway, so that is Running Dog. That is monthly. So stay tuned. That's coming up next in April. And now I'm going to take a track. This is It True from Tame Impala off The Slow Rush. You are tuned into So Hot right now.
Talking about everything from the past to the past. Have you ever wondered where Muji's clean, minimalist style comes from? Learn about the Japanese craft movement that influenced the likes of Muji and Marie Kondo at Seikatsu Kōge, Objects for Intentional Living, exhibiting at the Japan Foundation Gallery from February 21st to May 23rd. The Japan Foundation Sydney sponsors 2SER 107.3.
Hello and welcome back to So Hot Right Now, your weekly dose of arts and culture. And right now we are talking about Holi, which happens every year and decorates the streets of South Asia with total vibrancy. The festival sees people playfully throw coloured powder at each other to celebrate camaraderie and friendship. And this year, Fobgays, Trichone Australasia and CQ are bringing this massively popular festival to Australia with a rainbow-coloured twist. And I'm joined by Sid from Fobgays to tell us a little bit more about what we can expect. Good morning, Sid.
Hey, Nicole. How are you doing?
Good, thanks. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. Happy Holi, because it's actually... So Holi, the season kicks off on Monday. It's like a two-day kind of festival that goes on. So Monday, Tuesday. So happy Holi in advance.
Wow. It's so much sooner than I thought.
I'll get into this in a sec, but we're basically celebrating it a week after just because Mardi Gras just finished and, you know, people kind of need a little bit of a come down before they ramp back up.
Definitely. So can you maybe start by telling us about your collective Fobgays and also the other collectives involved and what everyone does?
Yeah, of course. So I am one of the co-founders of Fobgays, and it stands for Friends and Family of Brown, Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, Queer Plus People. So basically think of us like a queer, like a P flag, but for, you know, South Asian, brown people. And the reason why we started was because we realized that the family identity and the community identity is so important for queer people, especially queer South Asians, because, you know, we grow up with notions of family and you know, the people surrounding us as becoming a part of our identity. And so it's really important to have an allies network and an allies platform that also mixes with other queer people in that platform. So yeah, we're a bit of a hybrid there. Kind of started off as a random thing that my family started doing. And then we were in the Mardi Gras with like my aunt.
That's awesome.
Yeah, 2 years ago. And it just kind of spiraled into something amazing from then. The other organizations involved are also fantastic. So Trichone Australasia has been around for about, I think it would be over 10 years now. And what they do is they kind of provide like a social and support network for, yeah, queer South Asians themselves. And they, as I said, they've been operating in Sydney for a while. They've got branches all around the world as well, which is really cool. And they do some amazing events. So like every year they throw queer Bollywood parties, you know, at the Red Rattler or recently at the Factory Theatre.
Whoa.
Yeah, and they go off. They've got like, you know, 1,000 people coming at least. And then the last collective is CQ, and basically it's a group for, you know, women and non-cis men who identify as ethnic or people of color. And it is, I guess, more kind of bent to like development, you know, and like engaging with community, engaging with your profession and kind of building up your skills that way. And it's really, really important to have a space that, you know, that is for women and non-cis men and other people who don't identify with a particular gender to have a network like that. So yeah, their founder, Kamalika Dasgupta, has been on 2SCR a couple of times, and she knows what she's talking about.
And so how did the three of you all come together for this particular event?
Well, it's really funny because, you know, around about the time that Fobgays popped up, we started to see a lot of activity in like the South Asian queer space around the world, but here in Sydney, you know, like I think CQ had been operating for a year or so. And you know, Trichone, obviously, we all knew. And so we started coming to know each other just by virtue of the fact that like we met at Mardi Gras, we met at each other's events. And, you know, we always wanted to work with each other because, you know, we all do separate but complementary things. And yeah, one day, you know, last year we were like, let's make something happen. Let's do something big in 2020 that really can resonate with all of our groups, all of our missions, and bring them all together, you know, in one big hurrah.
So let's get into that hurrah. So which is Holi, which is an ancient Indian festival of colour celebrating the harvest in spring by throwing water and coloured powder on people. So what kind of role does Holi play in Australia in your experience kind of growing up, if any at all?
Definitely. So look, growing up in Australia, especially in a South Asian migrant household, like, we used to play Holi all the time, every year. And it would be like, it started off as this kind of, you know, backyard thing at my aunt's house where a couple of family friends would come over and we'd all, like, change into our daggy white clothes and then throw water and coloured powder on at each other. And yeah, in my aunt's backyard. And I remember kind of being traumatized by it when I was like 6 years old because I didn't like being doused in cold water.
Fair enough.
But, you know, as the years went by, like, you know, you really come to love it because it is such a fun time of the year. You know, everyone's gathering together. It doesn't matter how, like, old or young you are. It doesn't matter what gender you identify with, if any. It doesn't matter, you know, what class and status you come from. In India in particular, if you step outside your house on Holi, you will get coloured powder on you, right? And I think there's something really beautiful about the fact that colour doesn't discriminate. And it was like, that was always kind of in the background, understanding of how I and other people involved in this project saw Holi. But that's really kind of, you know, come to manifest itself as one of the big factors of our queer Holi.
And so, yeah, this event kind of adds a rainbow twist, ironically, to a very colourful event.
Yeah.
What does that look like?
So, I mean, you know, it's we all love puns and, you know, plays on words and stuff, right? But basically what we wanted to do is, because Holi is such a community-focused event, because it's such a massive celebration, because everyone is coming together, we saw this as a big opportunity to get, you know, the wider South Asian community, the queer community, locals, everyone who's interested, just in the same place to celebrate with each other, right? Because as from FobGaze, one of the biggest things that we have, that we try and focus on is just trying to get people to, you know, to meet different types of people and, you know, to have conversations with people they wouldn't otherwise come across in their own spheres. And this is kind of what Holi is hoping to do, right? Is get all of these people in the field playing Holi together, celebrating, having fun, and breaking down those barriers and those borders, you know?
And has Holi transformed at all throughout the years in your experience at all?
Yeah, I definitely have seen that Holi has started to become much bigger here than it was, you know, back when I was growing up. Like, now every year you'll definitely have like a big Holi festival. Often that's put on by the Hindu Council. You'll also have, like, you know, as I mentioned, families who play in their backyards have now evolved to actually going out into, like, you know, into parks and into public spaces and playing there. I've been to Holi at the Australian National University during that O week. So it's like, it is something that is celebrated more widely now and more people know about. And even the Colour Run was actually quite influenced by Holi as well.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Mm. Is that like a positive influence?
Well, I mean, I won't comment on it, I guess, because I don't know enough. I definitely think that there, you know, that there does need to be a little bit more transparency there around what they're doing. But yeah.
Yeah, fair enough. And so let's finish with what we can actually expect on the day.
Absolutely. Yeah. So basically our event is being held in Sydney Park next week, right near the kiosk. And it is going from 1 to 5 p.m. on Saturday, the 14th of March. Now, entry is free, which is fantastic.
Woo.
Yeah, I know. Because we wanted it to be open to anyone and everyone, right? We will be selling coloured powder there, I think, for $5. And that'll give you 3 refills. And that's basically just so that you can go and have fun with your Holi. So our game of Holi, which is when you actually start throwing the coloured powder at each other, will be kicking off at 2. We're going to have DJs there. We have food trucks, you know, gosleme, and we have like this Indian ice cream called kulfi. And we have, I'm not sure if you've been, but there's a new kind of like Indian kind of food store that's opened up near Wynyard called Flyover Frittery, that they operate in an alleyway. They sell pakoras, which are like Indian fritters, and chai. They're going to be there as well, which is really exciting. We announced our MC for the day, who is Radha Labia, who's a very, very prominent Indian, Singaporean Indian drag queen here in Sydney. Yeah, she is fantastic. She's done some amazing things. So really excited to have her on board as well. You know, there's going to be face painting and body painting, and there's going to be dancing. Yeah, it's all happening. So come along, Sydney Park, 14th of March, which is next Saturday, 1 to 5 p.m.
Cool. Great. I don't need to say any more details. You've nailed it.
Yeah, you can find the event on Facebook as well. If you just type in Rainbow Holi into Facebook, or if you head to the FobGaze page, FobGays.
And we'll also share those details on our show page if you look for So Hot Right Now on the 2SCR website.
Ah.
plenty of sources to go by. All right, great. Thank you so much for joining us on the show. It was a pleasure to talk to you and hear all about Rainbow Holly.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Nicole.
Anytime. I am almost out of time. I think I've probably got time for one more song. This is a new one out of Sydney. This is Bread Club with Never Go Again.
This is something you need to do. We can't avoid it. But there is so much we get from you. We can't afford it. When you fly away from here, we'll be supportive. Hopefully you won't be alone and get deported. But we don't know how. Forget your face, and you cannot ever be replaced, even though you are a million miles away. A million miles away. A million miles away. A million miles away. And some will pass on by, and they'll be some lonely nights. Never go again, never go again, never go again. Never go again, never go again.
A new track out of Sydney. That is Bread Club with Never Go Again. And you've been listening to So Hot Right Now, your weekly dose of arts and culture with myself, Nicole Beck. We've talked about a pretty wide range of things. We've had Sid from Fobgaze come in, tell us all about Rainbow Holly, which is happening on the 14th of March. Totally free. Get yourself there. I've spoken to Nathan Beard about his exhibition at First Draft, White Guilt 2.0. Amazing artist out of Perth. I highly recommend you go and check out that work on until the end of March. And we also had Running Dog come in and talk about Letter from the Editor number 2, which is part of our monthly segment with those guys over there. And if you want to listen to anything again, you can always head to our show page. If you look for So Hot Right Now on the 2SCR website, you can find all our past shows there and all details and any links you need to any of the things that we've spoken about. And until then, I hope that you all have a wonderful weekend, and we will speak to you next week. See you all later.